Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're asking, do we need protest songs now more than ever? In the past, artists like John Lennon, Woody Guthrie, Gil Scott-Heron and Public Enemy have all been associated with politically minded music, but more recently musicians have been criticised for not taking much of a stand. However, 2016 has seen plenty of change for people to get passionate about, and music is starting to become a driving force again. On today's programme, we'll hear from the music writer Dorian Linsky, musician Billy Bragg and Victoria Brokes, co-curator of a timely exhibition at the V&A about music and revolutions, to discuss the history of how peace and harmony have come together in the past and the modern-day lyricists who are voicing the hopes of a new generation. That's all ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. We're going to begin today's show by taking the temperature of the protest song. Music writer Dorian Linsky is the author of 33 Revolutions Per Minute, a history of protest songs, and he tells me who he thinks has the rallying cry within the music industry right now.
A lot of protest songs are not suitable to be used in protest, you know, like Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. This is not something that you can sort of sing at a rally or a picket line. You know, there's a reason why people still sing We Shall Overcome, Give Peace a Chance, these very old songs, because they're designed for group singing. It's the way that it's really about the melody. It's not about the recorded version. You know, the best versions of those songs are probably the ones that people sing around the world. But what's been interesting is that some of the hip-hop songs, like Kendrick Lamar's All Right, have taken on a life as something that people can chant at Black Lives Matter protests. That's when it gets really exciting, that it's a great record, but it also has this other life. And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I'll be looking at you from the face down. My Mac 11 even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. Where Pretty Pussy and Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing, and I wonder, so much hip-hop is, to use the word strangely maybe, but you know, is literate and is about things. It is not pure pop music. It obviously comes from somewhere. It was the underground music of the mid 80s and 90s. Do you think it's come into its own? Do you think it has broken across borders as something that is meaningful for the first time since NWA and Public Enemy in this US election?
I mean, there have been periods of time when it's been more meaningful. There were quite a few hip-hop protest songs around Hurricane Katrina and George Bush in general. But there's something about the rise of Trump parallel to the rise of Black Lives Matter, and that those two things, there's something to believe in and there's also somebody to oppose. And that's brought a lot of MCs who are not necessarily associated with politics. I think, you know, you've got a certain camp where it might be Kendrick Lamar or Public Enemy back in the day, where their modus operandi is fairly political. And then you've got people who, like T.I., or YG, two rappers that have put out anti-Trump protest songs this year. And that's not their brand, in a sense. And I think there's always something quite exciting about people that are often not addressing politics, addressing politics. And that's always been the case inside and outside of hip-hop. There's a special energy, you know, that you had with Marvin Gaye and What's Going On. He'd never been political before. So when he was political, it was a big deal. When James Brown did Say It Loud and Black and I'm Proud, it was a big deal because it hadn't happened before. It wasn't sort of the usual suspect.
And these protest songs, you mentioned Marvin Gaye and James Brown, when they came out, when they made political songs, made political statements within those songs, that was not without its complication, obviously, for the record companies involved, for even their band members, even for playing those songs live, presumably. Does now, in 2016, rappers like YG, who are maybe you wouldn't have thought of, as you said, as political stars making political records, what does that do, I wonder, to their regular fan base? I wonder if they find it enfranchising. Now I'm asking you to step into their world and imagine it a bit. But I wonder if you feel that is an enfranchising thing, or they go, I preferred it when they were, you know, I preferred it when it was more pure pop or more it was about different stuff.
Well, I think they move with the audience. I mean, even though, you know, black people were being killed by the police every year, you know, there's something about Black Lives Matter that's made it so present and so current. You know, the threat. Something about Trump that is just, I mean, you can't really sort of escape him and escape the anxiety around this election. So I think their fans are pretty excited to hear the occasional protest song. It's not like these people have, it's not like What's Going On, where Marvin Gaye, for one album, and really one album only, reinvented himself as a fully political religious artist. These are kind of one-off songs. They're very impactful. There's a series called 30 Songs in 30 Days that Shepherd Fairey has been involved with.
Yeah.
Getting a lot of different artists to do protest songs. Not so much hip-hop, but all kinds of artists. The people who've never done them before, like Franz Ferdinand, Amy Mann, you know. And there's something about this year that makes that seem like audiences are up for that, even if they're not particularly political. I don't think anybody's going to object. It's not the same as kind of completely reinventing yourself and going, right, I'm only going to do, you know, no more party songs.
I wonder whether, like, a good love song should encapsulate the weird and wonderful feeling that you have when you're in love. A protest song should be able to encapsulate one's frustration and hopes and dreams, I suppose, and great frustrations with more wit and wisdom and with great melody, or a memorable one at least. Is that the bedrock of what the protest song is, in a way? And when you know, as you said, this great 30 Songs in 30 Days project, things like this come out, that's what it does. It kind of allows people to be enfranchised in a pretty simple way by reflecting themselves back at them.
Well, I think it's a basic human need. You know, you can say that the sort of, you know, the job of art is to make you feel less alone. That can be a song or it can be a novel. It is empowering and sort of consoling for people to hear their thoughts and their anxieties mirrored. That's why certain clips of you know, TV presenters or talk radio hosts doing these fiery monologues, it's why they go viral, because people are like, great, somebody else is saying that on a public stage. And it's the same with songs. And, you know, YG's song, it's just called Fuck Donald Trump. And it really could not be more direct. I mean, the lyrics are a bit cleverer than that, but that's wonderful because it's so direct.
Express it in three words that aren't I love you.
Yeah.
Was the challenge, and you came up with Fuck Donald Trump.
It's just like, it is a pure expression of frustration, and there's actually quite a lot of sort of wit and detail in the verses. But people crave that, and the argument that I've always made about protest music is that the audience, you need the audience, you need the listeners. You can't sort of criticize artists for not speaking out when the general climate of the culture, you know, which has happened at various times, sort of mid-90s, when everything seemed relatively comfortable, you know, and I don't think people were craving political music, and therefore most artists weren't delivering it. And it's exciting when you can see these artists thinking, well, this is what I'm feeling, and it's also what a lot of listeners are feeling. And then there's a sort of cathartic bonding.
No, we can't be a slave for him. He got me appreciating Obama way more. Hey, Donald, and everyone that follows, you gave us your reason to be president, but we hate you.
Fuck Donald Trump.
Yeah, I suppose there's that thing, whether it's music played live or whether it's music you're listening to off the internet, on record, there's that deal that has to be struck between the performer and the audience has to fill in the gaps, the imaginative gaps, you know, in order to dig it, to make it come alive. Do you think that's happening with a lot of this, what, let's call it protest music, during this election, that actually there is a call and there is a large response from that audience?
Yeah, and sometimes live performances can do what, you know, records can't. There's a duo called Race from Erd who had a song not that old called Donald Trump, because for years Donald Trump was hip-hop's favourite mogul.
Yeah.
You know, because he's quite a hip-hop character. He's sort of very large and self-aggrandising.
See, this is the funny thing, right?
Dressed in gold. Loads of songs about him. They'd written one, not about him really, but just using a reference, you know, where, like, you know, rolling like Donald Trump or whatever. And now, of course, that's toxic, but it's one of their big songs.
Yeah.
So when they performed it live, they often preface it with a speech going about how much they hate Donald Trump and how this song isn't in any way praise of him. And that's something that's really interesting, that's something that's happened to that song in live performance this year.
You get a feeling that some of these guys, they miss a bit of the needle and the strife and the politics, and it makes them feel alive again. Maybe there wasn't something. Everyone needs a muse. Maybe it's, even if it's a negative one, and it often was for the original hip-hop stars, maybe this has kind of reinvigorated the genre. We talked a while back on this radio station about how Margaret Thatcher inadvertently made the best sort of pop, you know, allowed the greatest pop music of the 1980s to flourish, from Elvis Costello to the Smiths, by them hating her. And I wonder whether Donald Trump might inadvertently foster a new breed of engaged and brilliant hip-hop stars.
But you need, in all of those cases, you need these kind of vanguard artists. So it's not just a politician that you dislike. It's, you know, Thatcher came in 2-3 years after punk. So a lot of those exciting artists that were doing political songs with, you know, Costello or the Specials, that was because of punk.
Yeah.
And I think what you're seeing now is the Kendrick Lamar effect. I think he's done more to sort of popularize being political than anyone since Public Enemy. And he does it in a very different way. It's much more personal. It's much less sloganeering. But his example of actually addressing blackness has been hugely influential. You just see lots of artists thinking about that now. So you need that kind of, yeah, you need that political stimulus, but you also need a couple of really strong artists out there going, oh, look, it can be done, and you can win Grammys, and you can go platinum. You need those people to sort of change the conversation.
Yeah.
There have definitely been times when there's been, you could say with Iraq and George Bush, you needed Green Day's American Idiot, which was a huge record, a huge political record, to sort of go, oh, right, this isn't just a fringe thing. And I think what happens is that protest music never goes away, but at certain points it retreats to the fringes. It's the veterans. It's the usual suspects. It acquires a kind of worthiness and a predictability. And you do need, as pop music always does, new artists and new sounds and new developments to revitalize protest music.
Just finally, Dorian, what was your musical highlight of this election? Was there one song, one artist that stood out that kind of managed to corral the feelings for and against either a candidate, I wonder?
I suppose as an event, Beyoncé's Formation, the Super Bowl show, you know, sort of paying tribute to the Black Panthers at the Super Bowl, which is a mind-blowing thing, really. And then the Lemonade album and the video there and all of these ideas of, you know, of the personal and the political. So it's a very sort of rich, moving piece of art, both the album and the film, with sort of politics embedded in there, but not in a kind of hectoring, sloganeering way. And there was a tiny, feeble attempt to boycott her. And on her tour, she was selling Boycott Beyoncé T-shirts in this sardonic way because she knew nobody would. And I think, for me, I've always said it's incredibly powerful when somebody, a huge artist, you know, like when the Beatles did it or the Stones or Springsteen, whoever, when a massive artist is political and they're too big to fail, they cannot be slapped down. And for Beyoncé to do that at this point, I just thought it was incredible. Plus, it's sort of my favourite album of the year. And it's got something that's probably going to last longer than the real topical bulletins like Fuck Donald Trump, which are great, but they're not ones for the ages. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama.
Dorian Lynskey there and his book 33 Revolutions Per Minute, almost too perfectly titled, is available to buy now, published by Faber and Faber. We're going to step out of the studio now for a bit of historical context. The V&A's latest major exhibition is entitled You Say You Want a Revolution? Records and Rebels 1966 to 1970. The show explores how global civil rights, multiculturalism and consumerism during that period affected and were affected by the feelings of a divided world that weren't about to let the powers that be hold them back. Sound familiar? In a period where young people were experiencing a newfound freedom within fashion, the arts and travel, they also began to find their voices to promote peace and love through music, art and protest, as co-curator of the exhibition, Victoria Brooks, explains. Something called My Generation.
Well, the point of this wall is to underpin the fact that the whole exhibition is based on this idea that music was the means of mass communication in this period, 1960 to 1970. And if you just look straight ahead, you can see there Bob Dylan, The Times They Are Changing. That doesn't need much explanation. But next to him, you've got David Bowie on the front of The Man Who Sold the World wearing a man dress. This was a period when barriers and boundaries in all areas were being pushed back, and that's really what the exhibition's about.
Okay, well, should we go inside and take a look? Well, we're standing in front of the first case here, and we have four objects in here, but the one I really want to draw your attention to is a copy of Utopia by Thomas More from 1516, which is, of course, 500 years ago. And the reason we start the exhibition with that is because we're framing this period in the 60s around music and this idea of imagining better worlds and pointing out that
that has obviously been part of the human psyche for as long as there have been humans, but it does seem that in this era in particular, people were incredibly good at creating a kind of narrative around what they wanted and making it happen.
Was there a specific reason for you to do this exhibition now? I mean, we're having this conversation on the morning that Trump's just been elected as the new president of the United States. Was it the build-up of the presidential elections that made you want to do this now, or was there other reasons?
Well, I think that's really fascinating when you work on an exhibition, how while you're working on it, and of course it takes more than 2 years to put together something like this, hopefully as you move along you find more and more relevance in current affairs. And we always wanted this not to be a nostalgia trip into the 60s, but really a look at the 60s to see how it could inform how we think about today and also how we think about tomorrow.
And do you think this period was maybe a golden age for the protests?
It was, I guess, a golden age for maximum exposure of the protest song. So again, the exhibition is kind of carried on the music. We have LPs all the way through. They're borrowed from the collection of John Peel, great late broadcaster and presenter. And another thing I think you see in this period is the crossover between the influence of American music on British music. And I think it's interesting in an era when most people would never have got the chance to fly to the States. Cheap flights were still a decade away, but they could buy the same albums, they were listening to the same music, and the pop musicians were the icons of the era. And so they had tremendous influence. So, I mean, we've got music here, none of it's protest exactly, but it's, you know, it's an era when we've got Revolver on the wall there, very, very important album, very influential by the Beatles in 66. And music is just getting more serious. People are beginning to sing about their own issues, and they've taken that, the influence from people like Bob Dylan in America. And you do see a very nice kind of competitivism, but also a real desire to kind of take the best aspects from each other and use them between the musicians in this era. They're always going to see each other, watch each other on stage, and you know, George Harrison, I think, met the Byrds, who introduced him to the sitar in 65. So you've got that kind of thing happening all through this period.
Do you think perhaps what was happening back then was maybe a slightly more focused revolution, whereas now people want change, but they don't really know what change they want?
Well, I think that is absolutely key. There are all kinds of bonkers elements to some of the activities that we kind of show through the exhibition that you think, oh my God, that's so crazy. How fun and wonderful, but what on earth did they think they were doing? There are elements of that. But at the same time, you do see a driving narrative and these stories and an ability to imagine better worlds and then go out and make things that were seemingly impossible possible. And of course everybody's been saying for the last few years, and as is true, that there are no strong stories. You know, there wasn't a particularly strong story with Brexit. Nobody could really imagine things. The 60s, you know, whether it was that it was so driven by the youth, the sort of pictures of what they were seeking are very, very strong. I mean, the Beatles are interesting because Sgt. Pepper was more of an ideology than a political stance. And, of course, John Lennon does become very political later on in his relationship with Yoko. By 67, again, it's quite hard to understand, but I think probably the drugs had something to do with it. But I think peace and love, people really did feel, really believe that they could change the world. And the inner, that the sort of, if you open the album, Sgt. Pepper, and you get that, there's that lovely photograph of the four of them looking at you. And apparently Paul did say, look, everybody got to look with love, and that will communicate itself through the photograph to all the people that look at it. And that, talking about a sort of idealism and optimism that goes sort of way beyond what we might have now, you really see that in that statement.
But then it would be nice if there was a bit more optimism like that within what's happening now.
I think so. I mean, they're massively optimistic, and again that might be because they're all so young, but I feel that that's not the only reason, that there is an optimistic idealism that kind of sees no barriers, anything is possible. And another important element I think in this decade is the race into space, just in a sort of philosophical sense, it sets the sights, the ambition so high, this idea, and if you can get to the moon, you can do anything. And I think that's really what people are living with.
Reach for the stars.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
Okay, well, should we move on to the next room? So this room looks a lot at how young people are using, you know, the music and posters as a means of protest. How effective do you think the arts are as a way of getting your voice heard?
Well, that's another thing that they recognised in this period so well, that the use of humour, spectacle and artistic ventures in pursuit of progress were absolutely key. And I guess going back to that idea of creating a narrative, you want the narrative working at all levels and in many different ways. And so we show here theatre that was actual theatre, so Peter Brook's Tell Me Lies as a film and play US about Vietnam War. But also we have a piece in the case about the exorcism of the Pentagon, where they wanted to protest against Vietnam. They wrote to the Pentagon and said they'd like to exorcise creephood out of the Pentagon, and they were going to levitate it. And they wrote to the Pentagon and said, please, can we levitate you 100 feet? And the Pentagon actually wrote back and said, well, you can levitate us, but you can only go to 3 feet. And I think that is almost a sort of prime example in a whole exhibition of this strange thing that, although one thinks of it as obviously very much a youth push for change, there's also an element on the side of the sort of authorities of an acceptance of change, which again changes very suddenly at the end of the era when it's as if the shutters come down and they stop it all. But when the Pentagon wrote back and said 3 feet was okay, they were in a sense playing the game. But also the whole enterprise, the humour of that, I think underpins how, in how many different ways it went from real revolution, which I think you can hear in the background now, real revolution on the street, but also going through the arts in theatre, but also in bringing theatre and spectacle onto the streets.
And did the Pentagon ever levitate?
It didn't actually go up in the air.
In this room, we're in 1969, and we've sort of come from about 1966. How much has changed in that period?
Well, a lot, and actually, behind me, you can see, you know, the Abortion Act in 1967, legalised abortion, the homosexuality was decriminalised, theatre censorship was ended, contraception was available regardless of marital status. There are numerous legal changes that are affected in the period, but I think what we focus on in the exhibition is more the revolution, you know, what's been called the revolution in the head, and the change in people's mindset to a kind of independent way of thinking. That seems to be a sort of step change that isn't reversed, despite the many things that are not exactly reversed, but as the shutters come down, this era seems to end on a very sour note. You feel that it was all going swimmingly, and then it comes to an end. And I suppose what we wanted to do in the exhibition is kind of raise up that so much did happen, so much one they set out to do actually took place, but there are many unresolved things. And so environmentalism got going to a terrific start in this era. We had the first Earth Day in 1970. 24 million people turned out in the States for that, but it hasn't really got as far as people would have expected it to, given that. We have a section here on technology because of the interesting crossover between hippies and early computer pioneers, both believing that sharing knowledge would create a better world. And then the question of whether technology, which has transformed our lifetime, is the best thing that's ever happened to us or not the best thing that's ever happened to us. And are we actually out of control? I don't mean I think we're out of control of it, but I think in this era, people actually feel they can shape their world. And there's an element, I often think now when I read about technology, that it's being kind of, that it's going to happen. And we have to put up with it. There's less of a feeling, of an optimistic feeling that we can shape our future. And I suppose the whole exhibition we finish with Imagine by John Lennon alongside Jerusalem by William Blake, and a quote, which is the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And that, I think, is the message we want people to go out with.
That was Victoria Brokes, co-curator of You Say You Want a Revolution, Records and Rebels 1966-70 at the V&A, which is on until the end of February here in London. We're going to give the final word today to songwriter and well-known left-wing commentator Billy Bragg, who's never been one to shy away from musically vocalising his opinions on the state of things. Here he has a few words for the younger people about his hopes for the voice of a new generation.
There's power.
I've been writing about Englishness for a while now, and I think what's happened is really about England and England's sense of itself and where it thinks itself in the world. I think, you know, we're going to find out in the coming months and years how the world sees us. We're already getting a hint of that in the way that Theresa May came home from India with the message that, you know, if you don't want us to come to your country, then we don't really want to sell your stuff. You know, I think we're about to see ourselves again as others see us. But to me, the real question is generational. Do the young generation have a response to this? Because it's really on them. Some young guy said to me, "Oh man, what are you going to do now?" And I was like, "I mean, it's not about me. My generation, my generation have just kicked the stool away from your generation. It's really on you and what you are going to do." And you know, we're always talking about, "Oh, there's not enough political music around anymore," and all that kind of stuff. I don't expect young people to start writing, you know, "Between the Wars" and "There's Power in a Union." It's a different time. But I do expect to hear in some way from that generation about the pressure that they're under, and to hear them, Tim, step up and take responsibility for the situation that they find themselves in, although it's not of their creating. And I think that could be the most encouraging thing to come of this, because we are about to find out what kind of country we are. Those dice have been rolled, and we're yet to see the way the numbers come up.
With our brothers and our sisters, together we will stand.
That was Billy Bragg rousing the masses to take a stand. And that excerpt was taken from this week's sessions at Midori House, where he and Joe Henry popped in to play from their new record. Head to monocle.com to hear the full interview. And that brings us to the end of today's show, where we asked, do we need protest songs now more than ever? You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Damn the Torpedoes Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.